From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 15 years ago, August 29th, 2005, Hurricane Katrina hits Louisiana.
So you haven't heard about that water coming over that levee from the lake?
No, check it out.
Because the water started rising so high in my two-story apartment, I had to get out.
I need someone out here, man. I'm going to die in this attic. The water started rising in the attic, ma'am.
My roof blew off, ceiling fans falling down, bunch of falling, and we just hanging by thread.
I'm stuck in the attic, me and my little sister and them and my mama, and they got water in the whole house.
Daylight, and you still stood a good chance because you could see. But at night, you can't see nothing in that house, and all the power was out. So automatically, I was thinking, we might die. We might not make it out of here.
Voices there from residents of New Orleans' Ninth Ward. Now, Sarah Broom, for you, those are voices from the neighborhood you grew up in, from where your family lives. Welcome to On Point, first of all, Sarah. What does hearing back to those voices from 2005, what does it conjure up in you?
Oh, Meghna, thanks for having me. You know, listening to that, it made me think of the ways that loss and trauma maps its way within our bodies and within the body. And it instantly brought back for me, you know, what happened to my own family 15 years ago, and that it sort of begins with what we just heard, those voices, but that it's an ongoing trauma for so many of us. And it has long lasting repercussions. And of course, it instantly brought to mind what people are going through after Laura.
Of course. Well, I want everyone to know that Sarah is the author of The Yellow House. It won the National Book Award in 2019. It's a memoir of Sarah's family and the relationship to their home in New Orleans. So let's start, if we could, Sarah, in the present with you and your family. I mean, how are the members of your family doing today?
You know, it's interesting because we, around the beginning of this week every year, we feel it and we start to call each other and to check in. And, you know, after the storm, I only have a few siblings. Before Katrina, I had about 7 siblings living in New Orleans. Now I have 3 living there. And so, you know, many of the others are still displaced, actually, in places like California and Alabama. Mm-hmm. And this time has been extremely intense for all of us because of what is actually happening elsewhere in the world, so that we feel that 15 years ago is not 15 years ago at all. For instance, a sister of mine who lives now in Northern California, who lived in New Orleans all her life until Katrina, is now in the very town, Vacaville, where there are raging fires. And so the feeling for her is that she escaped water to go to fire. And so I think this moment feels very present for all of us.
Oh, wow. You know, you remind us very importantly, Sarah, that while so much of attention was paid to New Orleans itself, and rightly so, there is also the story of essentially these American refugees, right? Like members of your family who were permanently displaced. I mean, entire neighborhoods in the city lost their beating heart and soul, the people who lived there. And as you're pointing out, even within your family, have never been able to go back. I mean, that is a rending permanent loss.
That's absolutely true. And we know the evidence, the numbers show that even with billions of dollars given toward recovery, that who could return is very specific. I asked that question over and over in my book. Who can return? Who has the right to return? Because returning in a system of unequal distribution cost, and not everyone can pay, nor have they been set up to pay. And so, you know, I think what you're talking about also speaks to something, which is about the soul of what it means to be a member of a community, to be a native of a place, to feel tethered to ground, to land, and then to feel suddenly unmoored.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell me more specifically about what happened to the members of your family at the end of August 2005? And what was that unmooring that happened to them?
So in 2005, around August 27th or so, my family, nine of them, were getting ready to try to figure out where to go to escape Katrina. So I had a brother who was heading in his car to Missouri, and my mother got in a tiny car with my sister and her two teenage children and a brother and headed to a cousin's house in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Another sister and her children were going to Alabama. My 89-year-old grandmother, who had Alzheimer's, was in a nursing home. And all we knew was that she would be evacuated, but we didn't know to where. And then I had two brothers, Carl and Michael, who said they would leave, but didn't have the resources to leave, right? As many New Orleanians did not have the resources to leave. And so for me, who at the time lived in Harlem, those waiting days, not knowing where my family had landed or ended up, you know, 2 days after, my mother called from Hattiesburg and said that she and the group had arrived, but that there was water coming into the house. She said the house was flooding. We're calling for help. And right at that moment, the phone cut off. And none of us in the family heard from her or the group for the next 3 days. Mm-hmm. And that's what our life was like. My brother Carl on the roof for seven full days, waiting for help. This sort of agony of having your world upside down, and those of us who weren't there really not knowing anything about our beloveds.
Carl was on the roof for 7 days.
And, you know, eventually after those, he was there with his two dogs, Mindy and Tiger. And eventually he was rescued by actually a volunteer crew who put him and the dogs in the boat. And he was deposited on a bridge that we called the High Rise, an interstate bridge. And, you know, Curl took off the leashes. You know, the dogs didn't have any leashes. So he took off his own shoestrings and made leashes for the dogs and walked to the convention center, which is where he stayed for quite a long time. And my brother Michael, who also hadn't left, was in the Lafitte Housing Projects, which is no longer there. It was demolished, actually, after the storm. But he was in a two-bedroom apartment with 15 other people waiting out the storm. By the time he was rescued, he was put on a bus, on an airplane. He wasn't told to where. He only knew where he was when he arrived, which happened to be in San Antonio. You know, and for us, this fracturing, these fissures that were created are something we are still trying to mend. You know, my grandmother, who I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. was evacuated to Tyler, Texas, where she actually died 1 month to the day after Katrina hit. And so we all came back to try and bury her. And we returned to a city that was 80% still underwater, just to tally up the losses and be with each other and try to figure out what was left.
What was left? Wow. How long had your family lived in New Orleans prior to 2005?
So my family are New Orleanians as far back as we know. And it's the only place most of us know. It was shocking to understand that when people were suddenly displaced from home, for their connection to the city to present as so strong, right? I mean, New Orleans before Katrina was one of those places where the large majority of people living there were actually native to the place. I think 86% or some very high number, very unusual in America. And, you know, it was very hard for people to be away, and many resisted coming back, and others could not resist returning home.
Right. So this is why we wanted to start our hour today with you, Sarah, because the story of your family is a powerful example of how the story of what happened in Katrina isn't a 2005 story. Right.
Sure.
It's one that whose origins actually go way back in time. It maps closely to the entire history of New Orleans as a place and its people. I mean, do you see that? Do you see that as sort of your family living with the consequences of New Orleans history, and that how those consequences came to bear in 2005?
Absolutely. You know, first of all, there were literal storms within the history of my immediate family that people couldn't shake. And, well, you know, Betsy was one of them. And the parallels between Betsy and between Katrina are eerily similar. But even going a bit more personally into the lives of all of us, my grandmother bought a house in an area that was flood prone, that was by petrochemical factories, right? So the history of us feeling the fragility, the systemic injustice, the ultimate unfairness of the world around us always existed.
Well, Sarah, stand by for just a moment. We are talking on this week, the anniversary, the 15th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, about the bigger, longer, and deeper story of New Orleans and its people. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're looking back at Hurricane Katrina. It made landfall in New Orleans 15 years ago, but the story of what happened to New Orleanians is really a century, or was a century, in the making. And so that's what we're exploring this hour. And we're joined today by Sarah Broom. She's author of The Yellow House. It won the 2019 National Book Award. It's a memoir of her New Orleans family. And what happened during Hurricane Katrina. Sarah, before the break, you were telling us about your grandmother and your grandmother's house in particular. What year did she buy the house?
So she bought the house in the early 70s. And, you know, this was such a big deal. In fact, my mother, I just want to back up a bit and say my mother, when she was 18 years old, bought the yellow house where I grew up. And that house, on the day she moved in, she said it had to be built back up. The ground had to be built back up. It was already sinking on move-in day. And so this idea that this is deep and old, right? And that the ground is soft before you can even get your family in and settle, that it's already subsiding, I think tells such a big story. And then my grandmother buys a house, which is near petrochemical plants. And she makes a home within that house. That house is no less valued to her, but it's the only house that she can afford, you know? And even thinking back to my aunt, my mother's only sister, she lived in a neighborhood in the East, in New Orleans East, where I grew up, called Press Park, which was built on a toxic landfill. And so there were all of these sort of environmental issues. So the story of my family and their houses is literally the story of this unequal distribution of wealth and of resources and of systemic injustice.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, I wonder if you might listen with us for a few minutes as I turn now to Andy Horowitz, because that systemic injustice is the heart and soul of his new book. It's called Katrina, A History, 1915 to 2015. And Andy Horowitz is an assistant professor of history at Tulane University. Professor Horowitz, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been hearing Sarah talk about how just even in the story of the very homes that her mother, her grandmother, her aunt bought, where they were tethered to the land in New Orleans, the very ground there was already set up for disaster almost. So you look back beginning at as far back as 1915. Why do we need to look that far back in time to understand what happened in 2015?
Sure. And I should say, first, thank you for the honor of letting me share some time with Sarah Broom, whom I so respect. My book starts in 1915 with an account of an enormous hurricane, probably the most powerful storm to make landfall in Louisiana in the 20th century. And that storm arrived in New Orleans just as the city had finished building then state-of-the-art massive drainage system, a system of pumps that were meant to help the city expand beyond the high ground near the Mississippi River. Ever since New Orleans' colonial founding in 1718, people had lived pretty close to the river. It was the only really habitable place to build, but these pumps and this drainage system was meant to allow the city to grow. When this 1915 storm came, even though parts of the city flooded and people drowned, engineers and city planners believed that the city had passed a kind of defining test. The newspaper headline a couple days later said that the record shows that New Orleans is stormproof. And this confirmed their idea that the city should grow. And the neighborhoods that were built in drained swamps, you know, over the course of the 20th century were often among New Orleans' most desirable neighborhoods. These were places where you could go and buy a new single family house in a new neighborhood with a nice yard. From the perspective of 2005, though, if you trace the flood line that, you know, the flood that filled the city after the levees collapsed, what you're tracing is the city basically as it stood at the time of that 1915 hurricane. So the flood itself, you know, it didn't flood exclusively poor New Orleans rather than wealthy New Orleans, didn't flood exclusively Black New Orleans and keep safe white New Orleans. It was 20th century New Orleans that flooded. And seeing the flood's impacts that way unsettle, I think, many people's sense of Katrina, and also throws into the relief how much of the storm's disparate or of the flood's disparate impacts were less about the water itself and were more about a suite of recovery policies that followed it.
Okay. So tell me more about that, about the different threads of 20th century New Orleans that we should be pulling on here. You heard Sarah mention the fact that her grandmother's home, that petrochemical companies played a big role in the land that her grandmother's home was filled on. What role does oil play or gas play in terms of creating inequitable vulnerabilities in the city?
Oil is central to the story of 20th century New Orleans, as it is to the story of 20th century America. In the early 1920s, when oil was discovered in coastal Louisiana, it had the sort of happy accident of being in land that was held by the public. It was under public control. And the system that emerged, though, in response to that, and I trace in the book some nefarious and basically evil politicians who managed to privatize much of that wealth, often through the racist disfranchisement of voters, and frankly steal a lot of it. Now, some of that oil wealth inspired people like Louisiana Governor Huey Long, who helped to push the rise of the New Deal, and the Huey Long we have to thank in large part for Social Security. But most of that money was distributed really unequally, and you can look at it as a kind of origin story for just the incredible poverty and miserable poverty that exists in Louisiana in the face of extraordinary wealth. And at the same time...
Just, yeah. I'm sorry to jump in there, but I mean these stories really matter. So I was wondering if you could actually just tell us in more detail. I think one of the politicians that I was going to mention Leander Perez, but if there's another one that we should talk about, go ahead.
No, I was gonna mention Leander Perez as well. He was the district attorney for Plaquemines Parish. Plaquemines Parish is the county that sort of spans the last 100 miles of the Mississippi River, just downriver from New Orleans. He was the district attorney from 1924 to 1960, and he is famous as a racist, basically, and deservedly so. He was a staunch segregationist, and he manipulated the public agencies that controlled a lot of Louisiana's oil wealth, and basically deregulated them and made it possible for him to pocket a lot of the money that otherwise could have gone to the common good. There's more than enough money in Louisiana's what had been its natural resources that could have paid for flood control to keep everybody safe. Instead, he stole a lot of it and then donated some of it to fund the presidential campaigns of people like Strom Thurmond and George Wallace, famous racists who helped to give shape to the modern conservative movement, which continues to be in the thrall of a deregulated oil industry that doesn't just produce this terribly unfair distribution of wealth, but also specifically in New Orleans and in Louisiana, in order to access oil offshore, oil companies dredged canals through the wetlands that surround Louisiana. And those canals allow saltwater to intrude and cause basically the wetlands to collapse. So New Orleans until the 20th century was buffered from the Gulf of Mexico by many hundreds of miles of wetlands, but that has largely collapsed. More than 2,000 square miles of wetlands around New Orleans have collapsed over the course of the 20th century. So the city itself is now a coastal city and much more vulnerable to storms. And as we burn the oil that's shipped through those marsh canals, the world warms, the seas rise, the hurricanes grow stronger and more frequent. So that addiction to oil both poisons families like Sarah Brooms that have to live near the refineries and imperils everyone as it contributes to the climate crisis.
Sarah, did you want to comment on what you're hearing?
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I just feel that there's no way to separate a global climate crisis, right, from what we're actually seeing in all of our American cities. And, you know, I always remember that this was something I understood at a very young age. I understood that in New Orleans East, where I was growing up, that when it rained in the yard, the water would sit and pool and it wouldn't drain, right? And so my 8, 9, 10-year-old brain did not understand this. But now I do. And I understand how old and how systemic it is, and that the time is now, and we have to address climate, really, to see any of these things change.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about it briefly, because there's so many threads here, but the petrochemical companies, what are some of the other forces in the early or even pre-1965 New Orleans that really, Andy, you think are important to understand here?
Well, one of the kind of perverse threads of New Orleans history is that I said that pump system that was finished in 1915 enabled the city to grow. And for much of the 20th century, the people who moved into those new neighborhoods, those lower-lying neighborhoods, were white people who worked very hard to exclude black people from being able to move into those new neighborhoods because they were seen as desirable in every way. Black people were made to live near toxic waste sites or near the, you know, industrial uses that sort of lined the Mississippi River. And so paradoxically, that environmental racism, which was endemic in New Orleans, actually protected black people from the threat of floods for much of the 20th century. And it explains why by the time, you know, we come to 2005, some people who one might imagine would be the most disadvantaged New Orleanians, so residents of public housing, for example, public housing largely did not flood mm-hmm. or was not terribly damaged in 2005. Sometimes people imagine Katrina as that the flood itself somehow was racist or sought out the most disadvantaged New Orleanians. The flood's impact itself is much more complicated and much more diverse. As we look now back from the perspective of 15 years and ask who was able to return and who wasn't, we see how many of the flood's impacts were reapportioned onto the backs of people who were already disadvantaged.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah, you know, these are the kinds of conversations that I do authentically wish we had several hours, because this walk through a century of history it demands more time than we have to give it. So forgive me, both of you, but I want to actually move forward to 1965, because Sarah, you had mentioned Hurricane Betsy, which mm-hmm. was a massive disaster for New Orleans. Can you tell us what happened to your family in 1965?
So, you know, it's interesting because my mother had, and my father, and at that time there were four children. They had only recently moved into the Yellow House, which, is in New Orleans East, as I said, and then the storm happened in September, right? So there were only a few months that they actually had in the house before the house was completely damaged inside and out, and with my family narrowly escaping. And at the time, my father actually was a guy who worked maintenance at the local NASA plant. And he was at work when all of this was happening. So it was my mother and many of my siblings who were struggling to try to escape. But, you know, so much of Betsy and the rebuilding eerily foreshadows what happens 40 years later.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, at the time in 1965, Betsy was the worst national disaster the country had seen, and flood walls collapsed in New Orleans. I mean, Andy, you write about how the damage and the loss was particularly acute in several neighborhoods, including the Lower Ninth Ward. Will you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it was colloquially called Billion Dollar Betsy because it was the first storm that was considered to have caused $1 billion in insured damages. And it was the big one until Katrina. And as Sarah said, it's eerily reminiscent of what happened during Katrina. A storm surge came into mm-hmm. Lake Pontchartrain, entered into the industrial canal. The flood walls collapsed and flooded over the Lower Ninth Ward. The Lower Ninth Ward was then and remains a predominantly Black neighborhood, but it was important to recognize it was a neighborhood of homeowners. Black people in New Orleans disproportionately mm-hmm. owned their homes at much higher rates than people in the rest of the city. This was a place where people had moved to realize the American dream of owning their own home in a new neighborhood. But then one of the most heartbreaking moments for me in researching my book was discovering a cache of letters that those homeowners in the Lower Ninth had written to their congressional representatives in 1965 after the flood, asking for basically reparations for this failed infrastructure. They wanted grants that would allow them to rebuild somewhere safer. And they submitted this large petition asking for grants. And what they got as disaster relief instead was loans from the Small Business Administration. And the loans required collateral, which meant the only collateral these people had were their flooded homes. So this federal policy forced people to rebuild in a place that they now understood was murderously vulnerable to floods. And the truly heartbreaking part for me was that as I read those letters in the archive at Tulane University, they had been flooded by Katrina. So they were very difficult to read because they're just, you know, in the paper itself was the damage that these people had foresaw 40 years earlier, where they had proposed a solution that would have gotten them and their descendants out of harm's way. And having been ignored and dismissed, there were the costs right in my hands.
So Sarah, I think I remember in 2005, as the nation was watching what was happening to New Orleans, many of us were naive right? Deeply naive, mm-hmm. and thinking, how could something like this happen? But of course, both your story, your family's story, and the history that Andy's laying out before us tells us we should not have been surprised at all.
Sure.
What do you think about the fact that the nation was shocked?
I mean, that has so much to do with our difficulty really contending with our history and our past. Because if we're looking closely, and I think if we're paying attention, we see the ways that this injustice is literally baked into the American soil.
Well, we are talking about Hurricane Katrina 15 years later, and really the lessons we ought to learn. Sarah Broom joins us, and so does Andy Horowitz. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to do another one of our voter roundtables. You might remember that last week we spoke with three voters who supported President Donald Trump in 2016 and why they weren't going to do the same this time around. So tomorrow we're going to be talking with people who are either voting for or thinking about voting for the Democratic nominee, Joe Biden. And we want to hear from you. Are you casting your ballot for Joe Biden with enthusiasm, or maybe you're one of the folks who are doing so with reservations? What are you still making up your mind? What are the things that you want from and for your candidate? And how do you think the campaign has been going so far? Call us with your thoughts about why and whom you're casting your ballot for. We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the lessons that the nation ought to learn from Hurricane Katrina, and why really we had a century before Katrina, which made landfall 15 years ago. We had a century to learn those lessons. I'm joined today by Andy Horowitz. He's author of Katrina, A History, 1915 to 2015. And by Sarah Broom, the National Book Award-winning author of The Yellow House. Now, Andy and Sarah, of course, Sarah, you mentioned this earlier, we cannot escape notice that we're having this conversation as another hurricane has recently made landfall in the region. So let's listen to a little bit about what happened just over the past several days.
When I first got out of the bunker after the storm, I expected to see some roof damage. I mean, I expected to see some flooding, some trees in the road. We saw that. We saw power lines. What I didn't expect to see was there were literal entire buildings that had been blown apart. There were facades of brick buildings that had been around for 100 years that were blown down. I was really blown away by the devastation of some of these buildings. It was pretty intense.
So that's Nick Hunter, mayor of Lake Charles, Louisiana. He was on the Today Show recounting the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Laura. So joining us now from New Orleans is Jarvis DeBerry. He's editor of the Louisiana Illuminator. In 2005, he was on the team of the Times-Picayune journalists who were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of Katrina. Jarvis, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Meghna. I appreciate it.
So first of all, tell us a little bit about the immediate aftermath of Laura.
It's pretty destructive. I mean, people are really suffering. Last Friday, the Department of Health announced that 10 or 11 hospitals in southwest Louisiana had had to evacuate patients. This was after the storm because there were more than six dozen public water systems that had been knocked offline by the hurricane. So some of those water systems have been damaged directly. Others are incapable of getting water to their customers because of the loss of electricity. And right now we are experiencing some heat index is up to 105 degrees, so the heat is just unbearable, and people don't have water to drink. And we're, as everybody knows, in the midst of a COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic, and one of the most persistent public health advisories is for people to wash their hands. And now they're in a situation where they don't have water even to do that. So health officials are concerned not only about the aftermath of the storm, but also how it might exacerbate the COVID-19 pandemic.
Mm. Now, Jarvis, hang on here for just a second. Sarah, can I just turn back to you for a moment? Because we heard that tape from Nick Hunter, the mayor of Lake Charles. And do you have a relative who lives in Lake Charles?
I do. I have a nephew who lives in Lake Charles. Who is, you know, in a position where he's trying to figure out what to do about his house that has been destroyed. So, you know, I think listening to the mayor made me think so much about infrastructure and how this is going to have a profound impact on generations, on multiple generations, the devastation of place, of neighborhoods and of houses. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Jarvis, I mean, to that point, one would hope that there would be more sort of infrastructure resilience, especially in the 15 years following Katrina. I imagine is there a great deal of frustration amongst residents who have once again lost everything?
Well, I think you have to acknowledge that New Orleans and Lake Charles are far apart, and they are vastly different landscapes. So there have been great infrastructure improvements in New Orleans and in the New Orleans area. And New Orleans is better protected from a storm that narrowly misses it, as Katrina did, than it would have been 15 years ago. Lake Charles is a different story. And I think Professor Horowitz could tell you that the history of Louisiana has basically been to protect places that have already been destroyed and not to preemptively protect places such as this. So you may see infrastructure improvements in Lake Charles going forward, but the emphasis after 2005 was protecting the New Orleans metropolitan area.
So, Andy, did you want to comment on that?
It's a great turn of phrase, protect things that have already been destroyed. And it points to a sort of national habit of trying to repair on the back end rather than investing in protection in the front end. And you know, of course, it's a catastrophe to lose a home. The thing that we worry about, first of all, though, is just the basic protection of human life. And here it's simply inexcusable that there are people in America or anywhere that have to worry about the possibility of evacuating. I know there were many people who remained in Lake Charles and had to witness that storm, not because they chose to stay, but because they didn't have the means to get out or anywhere to go. Looking back at Katrina, for example, we know that 130,000 people or so remained in New Orleans when the flood came, and that's almost exactly the number of people who lacked access to a private vehicle. So it's not that anyone chooses to stay. It's that they often have no choice at all. And, you know, if you expand the frame even further and have a sense of history, then you can see that the federal government spent billions of dollars to build a federal interstate highway system that makes it pretty easy for people with a car to get out of town on short notice. In the case of New Orleans, that interstate highway system went right through the historic Black commercial district on Claiborne Avenue. So, you know, it sometimes looked like lucky people manage to beat the odds, but we have to pay attention to the way that history loads the dice in favor of some and not others. And as we look at Lake Charles recovery, I fear that what we're going to see is protections for people or few protections for people who need them the most.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And Meghna, if I might add, Hurricane Katrina struck on a Monday. That Sunday morning, my church in New Orleans had a very, very brief service. And there was a woman there who was at the service because she had shown up to work at her hotel that was a few blocks away. And they told her that she didn't need to be there and she could go home. But she came to go to work. There was no, she didn't think it was possible for her to take off just because there was a hurricane coming, because what if the hurricane didn't hit? Then she risked being fired. And so I don't think enough attention has been given to the economic situations that lead people to stay. And Laura, just like Katrina, was an end of the month hurricane where people may have the smallest amount of their bank in their bank accounts. And so you're having a situation where people feel, okay, I have to stay, I have to work, you know, I don't have sick leave, I don't have a vehicle, I don't have any way to get out, I need to pay the rent, I need to pay my bills, I need to eat. And so people are often making these economic choices in the hopes that the worst case scenario won't materialize.
Sarah, did I hear you nodding in of affirmation there?
Yes, that's me nodding. I think that's absolutely right. And we have to remember that many of the people who are disenfranchised are struggling to begin with, right? That this is cumulative loss and cumulative trauma for many people.
You know, Andy, I want to spend the last 7 or so minutes we have on the show actually exploring with all three of you really what are the lessons that collectively we ought to take forward from all of this. And one thing that I hear and read in your book, Andy, is that there's these interlocking threads in history that set a stage for a disaster. But perhaps at the time, I don't think you couldn't have pointed to any one particular thing and said that might lead to something terrible. So, what I'm saying is history allows us to see the big picture. Do you think that we're applying those lessons properly now? Do you think that the federal government or the Louisiana state government, that they are seeing the big picture now of what needs to be done to really protect people?
No. I think, you know, the big picture for me is that, with many exceptions, America is basically designed as a machine for creating and reproducing racial and economic inequalities. And it becomes particularly clear in the case of disasters and disaster relief, because our disaster relief policies, for all their variations, whether applied to housing or education or infrastructure, are often designed explicitly to just put things back the way they were before. And that can seem sort of common sense. You know, what could you want more after a storm or a flood than simply a return to normal? But another way of saying that, return to normal in the places that we live, that means a restoration of inequality. And the pre-disaster normal is often the very history that gave rise to the disaster itself. So as we try to prop things back the way they were, rather than dismantling that machine, we simply set ourselves up for the same or even worse failures in the future. So I think the sort of big picture response to not just Katrina and Hurricane Laura or the climate crisis writ large is to stop treating these as sort of episodic attacks from outside of our history, and rather understand that they are the culminations and manifestations of a history that is often designed to produce suffering, and to realize we have to dismantle that machine entirely.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jarvis, I wonder though, is there no recognition that we can't go back to that previous normal? Because I think there might be at least piecemeal evidence that there is some. I'm thinking of, isn't there a FEMA program now, something like $500 million that is available or ostensibly available to help relocate people so that they don't go back to the places that are so vulnerable to begin with?
I think, as Sarah mentioned at the beginning of this program, people have a strong attachment to home and a strong attachment to place. And so people are always being pulled into multiple directions. I appreciate Professor Horowitz mentioning what I did not know, that there were people in the Lower Ninth Ward in 1965 asking for money to relocate to someplace else. That has not been the norm of the federal government. Generally, as he said, the norm has been to put things back exactly the way they were, to put people back exactly in the places that they were. In addition to that, you have people in New Orleans who, as Sarah mentioned, were incredibly rooted. Most of the people who were there were from there. I knew a family in 2005 that my relatives in Mississippi helped take care of. There was a woman who had been born, I think, in 1921, and 2005 was the first time she had ever stepped foot outside of New Orleans. And so there were people there who knew no other place to be. And I think you have to acknowledge that there are people who love New Orleans and want to be in New Orleans and don't want to be any other place but New Orleans. Yeah. And it's a difficult. I think there should be policy decisions that allow people to leave. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize that there are people who are not going to want to leave because they have those yellow house experiences. They have those places, those stories that attach them and keep them rooted to that place.
Yeah, I'm glad that you emphasized that, because I hope my question didn't sound flip, like that the solution is to people should just up and move, because that's not at all what I meant. I'm just trying to think of, you know, coming back to the issues of climate, because we have this, what seems to be a permanent change of more frequent, more intense hurricanes. And as Andy has been, you know, laid out in his book, we have an entire landscape, a political and physical landscape that has been shaped in a certain direction. For Sarah, I'll let you have the last word here. For families and lifelong New Orleanians, What do they need to stay resilient, to be protected, short of having to possibly think about leaving the city that they know and love so much? What would most help people?
Well, I think so much of this comes back to policy. And I just want to quickly say that we cannot dismiss the fact that often after these events, there's an intensification of the inequality, actually, because we saw that after Katrina, rents increased by 50%. Right? That people were given housing vouchers that intensified segregation, that put them even further out of the city center, making it harder to get to work and to jobs. And, you know, so much of, I think, what we do is we detach the housing policy and city planning and zoning decisions, you know, decisions about the environment and about school from the actual human beings whose lives are impacted. And so I think at base, for any of this to change, we need to value these lives in the first place, and that's the root of it all.
Well, Sarah Broom won the National Book Award in 2019 for her memoir, The Yellow House. Sarah, thank you so very much for joining us
today. Thank you for having me.
And Jarvis DeBerry, editor of the Louisiana Illuminator, he was on the team of Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists who covered Katrina in 2005. Jarvis, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Andy Horowitz, author of the new book Katrina, A History, 1915 to 2015. We have an excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. Andy, thank you.
Thank you.
This is On Point.